So the sweet potato, as you know, originates in the Americas and was spread throughout the world by the Spanish Empire. In particular, the Spanish brought it to the Philippines. Now, the Philippines were also a satellite state of China at the time, and all satellite states of China were required to submit some unique cultural tribute to the Chinese Empire that no other country could provide, and the Philippines thought it's a wonderful opportunity, so the sweet potato came to China, and from there was spread around the other Chinese satellite states and arrived in Okinawa. Now, the Ryukyu Kingdom in Okinawa had very little natural resources and had to make up for it with the ingenuity, much like my previous country. And much like my previous country, it had a special relationship with the superpower and had an exemption that it was the only country that was allowed to re-gift. So it didn't have to produce something unique of its own. It could take something that came from elsewhere, and as long as they put a special Okinawan twist on it, they could then re-gift it back to the Chinese motherland. So the Okinawans were very happy to discover that when planted in what is now Yomitan Village, sweet potatoes can grow purple. Okay, so look, after the seminar, please, our famous purple sweet potato in snack form. Now, for those of you who don't know or don't remember who I am, so I'm the crazy person who tries to think about hairspin gravity in the sitter space, which I might try to convince you is the natural consequence of noticing three facts about the world. First, that there's a non-zero h-bar, there's a non-zero g Newton, so you want to do quantum gravity. Now, I'm one of the people who think that our string theorist friends have done pretty good at that, and that the best they can do is ADS-CFT. And ADS-CFT, of course, relies heavily on the fact that you can run away to spatial infinity and forget about all your problems there. And this requires a negative cosmological constant. Right? So the third relevant fact about our world is that it has a positive cosmological constant, and it is impossible to run away to spatial infinity. Okay? And the simplest geometry with positive cosmological constant, which is not quite our world is more complicated, but it describes the asymptotic future of our world seemingly well, is a four-dimensional de Sitter space. I usually draw it as a hyperboloid because it can indeed be embedded as the hyperboloid of unit space-like radius in five-dimensional flat space-time. Okay, so I am always thinking in this so-called embedding space picture. It's very convenient. Okay, and the key property of the setter is that instead of seeing all the way to spatial infinity, every observer is confined to a region of this shape, which normal people would call a causal patch or an observable patch, but unfortunately, we are stuck with the name static patch, because its metric can be written in static coordinates. Okay, it has an initial horizon and a final horizon, which in our case would be around 100 billion light years. And beyond this, you cannot see. Okay, so somehow you need to figure out how to live inside such a region. Okay. Now, The setter is not completely unlike ADS. It's just one sign reversed. It also has a conformal boundary, much like ADS has, but the conformal boundary of the setter is special in two ways. First, it is this space-like hypersurface, and its boundary not at spatial infinity, but at future and past infinity. So if the roles of space and time in holography, if you try to do it, get reversed. And second, that this boundary is unobservable. Okay, it's mostly, except for these single intersection points, outside of any observable region. Okay, so if you want to be a stupid monkey, which I am, and just try and take the success of ADS CFT and replicate it, then you have two problems ahead of you. So the first is to analytically continue from ADS to DS, flipping the appropriate sign. And second, to figure out how to go from talking about the boundary to talking about the region inside horizons. Okay, now already the first part nearly kills you. Okay, if you analytically continue practically any known model of ADS CFT, you get one form of or another of garbage. Either you get bulk states with negative norms, such negative kinetic energy, or you get complex conformal weights in the CFT, and that doesn't make sense. Usually everything at once. Basically, people don't understand how to do string theory in the sitter. But there is one loophole. There is one model of ADS CFT, which is not built on string theory, but on a smaller cousin of it, which is called higher spin gravity, or sometimes Vasiliev gravity. And in the simplest possible case, this is dual to a so-called free vector model. So that just means essentially n free massless scalar fields on the boundary. Okay, so we have this one of the simplest holographic models, and it's the only one known that is simple enough that when you analytically continue it to the sitter, it doesn't break. Okay, this was noticed, so the duality itself is was noticed at around 2001 by Klebanov and Polyakov. The fact that it works for the sitter was noticed 10 years later for absolutely no good reason. It's just that people don't think about these things. By Strominger, Dioaninos, and Hartmann. And so you have this one strange, unrealistic, you know, for the people who don't like string theory because it's not realistic, this guy is worse. It's highly non-local and has infinitely many massless fields, which are of course not observed in nature, etc. But it's a model that you can work with that at least gets you past step one, and you can begin to think about step two and how to talk about observable patches in the set. Okay. Now, the set of people who take everything I just told you seriously simultaneously and they're trying to do something about it, it is inexplicably, as far as I know, only me. Okay, so with my limited talents, I'm slowly hacking at it. So from what I told you so far, you will not be surprised to learn. What is my currently favorable observable in all of physics. So if we take flat spacetime and ask, you know, what's your best observable, then in QFT you can do many things. You can calculate things in some local spacetime regions. But once you get to quantum gravity, you will be told by the grown-ups that no, good observables are only defined at the boundary. At infinity, you should talk about the S matrix. If you're in anti-de Sitter, they will tell you the same thing. You should talk about correlators at spatial infinity, which the CFT will calculate for you. So if you are in de Sitter, then you have this circumstance that you are stuck in between the two horizons. So they are your next best choice. Instead of talking about the maximally special hypersurface, which is the boundary of the entire spacetime, let's talk about the still slightly special hypersurfaces that are the horizons, the boundaries of the maximal observable patch. And let's ask what is the evolution of fields or states or whatever you want from initial horizon to the final one. And this is what I'm going to call the de Sitter S matrix. These words are widely used to mean all sorts of different things. There's nothing I can do about that. This is what I will mean for today. Okay. When people say S matrix, they usually talk about states evolving into states. For me, it will be a bit more comfortable to talk about fields or quantum mechanically field operators evolving into fields. The difference between the two is simply that states are normally constructed as field operators acting on a vacuum. And in de Sitter, there is a separate not very helpful now discussion about what you would like to choose as the vacuum. So like, if we understand how fields evolve into fields, then you can plug in any choice of vacuum that you want and get states to states. All right, so here you have like a clearly fundamental and very simply stated problem in mathematical physics. I'm saying mathematical physics because our real world has a big bang in the past. So our past horizon looks nothing like this. But still, okay, if we want to understand worlds with positive cosmological constant, seems like a good idea to start here. Okay, so what is the S matrix for an observable patch of the de Sitter space? Yes, sir.
So in flat space time, when we talk about an S matrix, usually we're allowed to do this because if, you know, at early times, say, or let's say at late times, wave packets separate from each other and their interactions become smaller.
Mm-hmm.
With the horizon, it seems like you don't have, is there anything like this feature? It seems perhaps.
So you don't get to say that. However, the problem remains well defined. So you no longer get to say that in some let's say neighborhood of the horizon, you know, the particles are not close to each other or whatnot, but two things are still true. So first, the problem of let's specify some fields here, how will they turn into fields here, still makes sense. In quantum field theory, talking about gravity is a separate complication. But also we get the extra perk of working not just with any old kind of boundaries, but light-like boundaries, where some magic happens. So part of this magic is rigorously proved, part of it is hand-waving. But basically the statement is that if you have field data on a light-like hypersurface, then all the interesting structure, so the commutators at different points and the structure of the vacuum are the same as in free field theory. Because basically you have a Hamiltonian for going along the light-like direction, which stays inside the hypersurface, and then is what people call kinematical. It doesn't require you to know how to evolve off of the hypersurface. So it talks only about your initial data itself. The lowest eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, aka the vacuum, can be defined in terms of that. Okay. So even though we're not sitting infinitely far away, and the kind of stories told to children about why the S matrix is nice don't apply, some of it secretly does. Okay. So this problem of evolving from here to here and is certainly seems well defined for non-gravitational field theories. Like okay, let's ask it for young Mills. For GR, you can do it perturbatively. At some point, when you go to higher loops, you will of course fail. For the ordinary reasons, but you can start and do things at tree level. Non-perturbatively, even classical GR will give you a major headache because the horizons will simply no longer have this shape. You can make black holes, they will change the structure of conformal infinity and so on. So for QFT, the problem seems well posed. Going up to GR, it's kind of you can start, but once you get to the really interesting questions at the quantum level, we don't really know what we're talking about. So here a very general disclaimer: when talking about quantum gravity in the sitter, people are stuck on 20 conceptual problems at the same time. I do not know if this S matrix question ultimately makes sense at all for GR at the quantum level. Likely not. But since you may have noticed that I sold my soul to a particular devil here, which is much simpler than string theory and much simpler than GR when viewed correctly. So I have a reason to believe, which I will try not to go into now, that for hairspin gravity, the problem is again well defined, and that solving it is basically my mission. Now, what do we know about answers to this? So it turns out that practically nothing. Okay. People have not worked on this at all. So what I want to tell you about now is mostly from our last paper, so 1906 blah with Nico Fischer, who is now a nice master student in Jena in Germany, and Adi David, who is a nice PhD student with the asset OIST. And now we need to put another X here, don't we? That we understood how to write the free S matrix, even for free fields. Of course, you can solve the problem for free fields just head on, you know, by doing the Green's function and integrating over the initial data and blah, blah, blah. But this is something you can always do. And it's really not something that you want to keep doing once you have interactions. So we know that drawing Feynman diagrams in space-time and integrating Green's functions over space-time points really kills you very quickly. So you need to find a smarter language that makes your symmetries manifest. And that is what we did for the S matrix of free massless fields. Okay, so I will describe that a bit. Then I will point out that that story has a surprising relationship, a holographic relationship, really, to the quantum mechanics of particles living on the boundary. Then we'll discover that they are exactly these particles, and that we've sort of discovered higher spin holography in an interesting, surprising sort of way. And finally, I'll tell you how, when you impose not just space-time symmetry, but also the extra symmetries corresponding to all the massless fields of higher spin gravity, then you can constrain the interacting matrix, the interacting S matrix, to a remarkable amount, with the result being that it is completely given by the free one with no interacting corrections, except in the so-called soft or infrared sector of zero frequency modes, which people lately have started, of course, to look at again in the context of flat spacetime, where they think maybe there are some important subtleties there in the S matrix of electromagnetism, Young-Mills, GR. So here we have the statement that in this toy sort of quantum gravity that seems to work in the sitter, actually the soft slash infrared part of the S matrix will be the only part of the S matrix that is non-trivial. It promises to be fun to study that in the future. Okay, so now, how do we do the free S matrix? Well, in flat spacetime, you would say Fourier transform into momentum space, and then the free S matrix is trivial. Right? Just the initial momentum equals final momentum, and you're done. Now, in the sitter static patch, we don't have that luxury, because essentially we don't have translation symmetry, and therefore no good notion of momentum. So the symmetries here are reduced from the full symmetry of the de Sitter group, which is just the group of rotations in the five-dimensional embedding space. So it is reduced from that to just time translations along the observer's timeline here, and three-dimensional rotations in space. In particular, we don't have anything like spatial translation, so we don't have momentum. Now, of course, you can take this symmetry as is, say, okay, if we have time translations, let's use a frequency basis. If we have rotations, let's use a spherical harmonic basis, and express everything in that way. Indeed, with a couple of students a few years ago, one of them Ilan, who's a Psi student here, we did that, and it hurt. The other was Lucas Hakkelden at Penn State. We did it just for the free conformally massless scalar, and I have no desire to ever do such a thing again. Like, I don't want to generalize it to non-zero spin. I don't want to generalize it to interactions. Just spherical harmonics suck. And I know I'm being a prima donna when I say such things. I know that a normal person would just assign a student to crunch it further and not care. But give me that. Yeah. This, I believe, is also part of the reason why no one really has worked on this S-matrix problem before. So what we're going to do instead.
That's a quick question on that.
Yes.
Are you able to use like the full Desider isometries and try to like write your functions in terms of the actual harmonic functions on global Desider space, or is that?
Well, yes, yes. So people are of course fond of doing that in the ADS business now, and that roughly goes under the name of Mellin space. Yes, but you would need
sensible restriction to the static batch after you did something like that.
The short answer is I don't know, and what I'm going to show you now is simpler.
Okay.
So it will not make manifest the full De Sitter symmetry, but as you will see, it will secretly use the full De Sitter symmetry. I'm going to give you translations now and momentum. So my most universal lesson from my experience with math/physics is that you should always look for square roots. Right? If you get the real numbers, discover the complex numbers. If you get vectors, discover spinners. So if you get a problem with two horizons, do instead the problem with one horizon. Okay. So suppose we solve the following. Not worry about what is observable or not, but suppose we ask for the transitions or mappings of fields between the conformal boundary of De Sitter, which has the full De Sitter symmetry. There it looks, of course, like the conformal symmetry in three dimensions, and a single horizon. Okay. Suppose we solve this problem. Yeah. Well, if we solve it for one horizon, then we solved it for any horizon, because they are all equivalent. And then we can just compose the two solutions together. So relate one horizon to the De Sitter invariant boundary, relate the other horizon to the De Sitter invariant boundary, and do this time this, and you related the two horizons to each other. Okay. Now here you will get the kind of the full extent of each horizon as opposed to just this observable half, but that is seriously not a big deal. Or you can always just cut it in half in the end, or what I like to do a lot is to talk about fields that are antipodally symmetric between the two halves, and then the cutting in half is trivial. But okay, if we solve a problem like this, then we are good. What is the symmetry of this problem? So just like the static patch is associated with the so-called static coordinates of the De Sitter, so a single horizon is associated, of course, with the so-called Poincaré coordinates. Where the metric looks like minus d conformal time squared plus flat space okay, warped by z squared. And then this has time slices that look roughly like this. The horizon in these coordinates looks like null infinity. So let's blow up the horizon a little bit. So instead of drawing it like a line, let's draw it more correctly as a cylinder, where the axis of the cylinder is a light-like direction. And then there's this two-sphere, the spatial section of the horizon. Okay, and we get this as a limit of taking both time and spatial radius to infinity with the difference between them, the retarded coordinate or whatever it's called, kept finite and giving the light-like coordinate here, while the unit, the direction of the spatial position becomes the position on the sphere here. Okay, so this is the horizon embedded in Poincaré coordinates. And the symmetries of the Poincaré coordinates are, of course, those of this flat 3D space. So translations, rotations, and dilatations. Okay, translations is good. Right? Our cosmologist friends will all tell us that when you solve de Sitter problems, and they usually mean in the Poincaré patch, they don't think about this, that you should Fourier transform the spatial coordinates and define momenta. Okay, now we are wise men. And as soon as we see a momentum, we take the square root of it and write this as some spinner times its complex conjugate. So we get something like spinner helicity variables. Now, what does that actually look like in terms of fields on the horizon? So we need to understand what translations when applied to the horizon look like. So the rotations of the 3D space are, of course, just rotations. And the translations look a bit funny, unless you have experience with the way translations work at null infinity of Minkowski, because it's exactly the same. So what translations do is they move the points of the horizon along the light rays. So the two-sphere stays the two-sphere, but it's tilted along the light rays. And the direction and degree of the tilt are determined by the translation vector. Okay? And then when you ask what are the eigen functions of such translations, what does a momentum mode look like? And you get an answer which, again, should make complete sense if you think about null infinity in Minkowski, which is that a mode with given momentum will be focused on just a single, supported on a single light ray on the two-sphere. Okay, given by the direction of the momentum. So that's so the unit vector on the two-sphere is the direction of the momentum. And here there will be a frequency along the null coordinate given by the magnitude of the momentum. Okay. So essentially, going from momentum space to field data on the horizon is a fairly trivial business. You just need to do a Fourier transform between the null time and the momentum's magnitude. Now, if we are talking about fields with spin, then we also need to take care of the spin indices. And of course, this is where spinner helicity variables really come in useful. Okay, so if we start with lambdas, then we can build, okay, once again, the unit vector on the two sphere. As lambda squared normalized, lambda bar normalized, and we can also build a null complex polarization vector with two lambdas instead of lambda and lambda bar. And it's complex conjugate. Then if we have a field with some spin with the S totally symmetric traceless blah blah indices, then we can encode the initial data on the horizon for its two polarizations by contracting either with S factors of the, say, right-handed polarization vector, or with the S factors of the left-handed. Okay, let us call these things for short, just scalar phi, which depends on the null time u, our position on the two sphere n, and also depends a little bit on the choice of polarization vector. Okay, so we have a transformation from the horizon fields to spinner helicity variables. So we make a function of lambda and lambda bar by Fourier transforming with respect to null time. Something like this. The field where this is that, and the polarization vector is that. Yeah. So all of this to say that now we have a nice encoding of the field data on each horizon. So we do it for one horizon, then we can in the same way, do it for the other horizon. Okay? The other horizon also has the same symmetry. The dilatations are the same dilatations, though reversed. The rotations are the same rotations. The translations are different. But with respect to the other horizon's translations, we can also define momenta and take their square root and come up with the spinner helicity function on the other horizon, which would be a Fourier transform with respect to the other null time, and so on, all the same. So now the question about the S matrix of the static patch has become, so what is the relationship between these two spinner helicity functions? So because the notion of momenta is different on the two horizons, it will not be just immediately trivial as it is in flat space time. But our statement is that it's the closest thing to trivial. And what's happening is that the final horizon is related to the initial one by simply a Fourier transform with respect to the spinner variables. Now, I want to stop and point out how absurd it is that I get to write this paper in 2019, and how absurdly neglected this whole problem space is. But, all right, so this is the answer. There are different ways of proving it. So you could just do it by brute force, again, just calculate the free evolution with Green's functions. You could notice that the interchange of the two horizons from the point of view of the spatial slices, in particular of the de Sitter boundary here, is actually an inversion that interchanges zero and infinity. So that what looks like translation for one horizon looks like special conformal transformation for the other. And simply derive this as the relationship between square roots of translations and square roots of conformal transformations. But my favorite way of thinking about this is in terms of twisters. So the ideology is the same one I sketched before about finding the S matrix through a square root, but we should relate first a single horizon to some global de Sitter invariant data. Okay, but now you see that we already moved the space-time data of the fields on the horizon into a fancier language. So from the horizon, we went to a spinner helicity. So likewise, as our global data for the fields, it's possible to do this in terms of the actual space-time fields on the boundary. But like the global analog of spinners is so-called twisters. Okay? For my purposes, the meaning of the word twister is simply that these are the spinners of the space-time symmetry group. Okay, which in our case is SO4,1, the isometry group in four dimensions. Originally, when twister theory was introduced by Penrose, he was thinking about the full conformal group in four dimensions. And that's the convenient place to start if you're thinking of flat space-time. But if you are thinking of space-time with cosmological constant, like de Sitter or anti-de Sitter, then already the group of isometries is this kind of higher dimensional rotation group. And you can just immediately start thinking about the spinners of that. Okay, so these spinners are four component, and they can be written in a nice basis that is adapted to a choice of two horizons as a pair of two component three-dimensional spinners, right? And there is this very nicely well-developed theory of free massless fields using this language. So the main statements there are that solutions of free massless fields in four dimensions with any spin can be encoded in the functions of a twister variable. Okay, the homogeneity of the function determines the spin. Space-time symmetry, the full space-time symmetry, rotations, translations, everything, is acting in this language very, very trivially as linear transformations of the twister argument itself. Okay, so it doesn't touch the function, but only the argument. Okay? Unlike, for example, the momentum basis, where rotations touch only the argument, but translations multiply the function by a phase. Okay? We can easily work out, in particular, how the subgroup, the symmetry of the Poincaré patch with a single horizon chosen, acts on this twister. So we can work out the action of rotations, translations, and dilatations. And from this, it immediately follows that if you now define a Fourier transform of the twister function with respect to mu bar, then the transformation properties that it will inherit are precisely the ones of the spinner helicity basis that we defined before, and are enough to identify it uniquely as the same thing as the spinner helicity function we constructed before. Yeah, and this again should be familiar from flat space stories of free massless particles, where you get spinner helicity functions by transforming one of two spinners in a twister function. Okay, but yes.
About these twisters, I think for like in flat space, you say that the twisters are like solutions to the twister equation, and it's conformally invariant, so I could solve it on de Sitter. Would those be these twisters, or would they be? Are these somehow different?
They would be these twisters. The missing part to make contact with your story is to take. This structure, which is just written in the five-dimensional embedding space, and interpret it as spinners sitting at different points of the Sitter hyperboloid. Okay, then it begins to make sense as a spinner field, which solves some differential equation. But yes, it is the same one. It's the same thing you're talking about.
I guess the thing might just be a detail, but the group SO41 would be different than the conformal group for flat space.
Right? It's a subgroup of the conformal group. The conformal group of flat space is SO42, fixing different cosmological constants picks out different subgroups of it. Okay. So, but now, by the square root ideology, if this is true for one horizon, then the same thing is true for the other horizon. And so by Fourier transforming with respect to the other spinner, okay, and here in the choice of this basis, I snuck in the fact that it's built so that interchanging the two horizons interchanges the two component spinners. So if we Fourier transform with respect to lambda instead, and in one of these there is a sign, probably here, then we get the spinner helicity function on the other horizon. Okay, and therefore, if we combine these two Fourier transforms and just do the Fourier transform of both spinners, then we go from one horizon to the other. Oh, do they also go up? Yes. Good. Okay. So this is what I have to say about the free S matrix. Now, let's notice that it has this peculiar structure. So we have this function of two lambda spinners. We have a function of two mu spinners. In between, we have a twister function that's mixed like this. This looks like something. What it looks like is different representations of an operator in quantum mechanics. So you can represent operators in a configuration basis from with matrix elements Q1, Q2. You can represent it in a momentum basis with the P1, P2. Or if you are one of our friends in quantum optics, say, you would like to represent it as a function on phase space, a function of Q and P. Okay? Of course, the two opposite ends here are related by a Fourier transform. We all learned that. If you learn just a little bit more, you will find out that there is a halved Fourier transform that also relates us to the middle picture, which goes by the name of the Wigner-Weil transform. Okay. So somehow, the free fields of different spins in the four-dimensional bulk are talking about the quantum mechanics of something in which the phase space is twister space. And there is also the symplectic form on the phase space whose role is played by the twister metric, or people sometimes call it the infinity twister. So what is this the quantum mechanics of? Okay. What is this the phase space of? Turns out that this has a very nice simple answer. That twister space is, and this is a sort of a simpler statement of what it is than Penrose's. So Penrose used a twister and its complex conjugate to construct phase space in four dimensions. But just the twister itself is the phase space of a massless, spinless particle in three space-time dimensions. Okay, it's possible to see this in some very nice ways. So in the embedding space picture, if we ask what is the boundary of the sitter, where would the three-dimensional particle live? Well, that would be the projective light cone in five dimensions, okay, the space of null directions. Okay, so a point in three dimensions is now identified with a light ray in five. And a phase space point for a free massless particle is a light ray in three dimensions. But in the embedding space picture, a light ray in three dimensions will become this two-dimensional, totally null plane. In the 5D picture. And if you know a little bit about what spinners in different dimensions are, or what twisters are, then you will know that this is precisely described geometrically by the square of a twister. Okay? So of course, there's the imprecision here that it's actually a double cover of phase space because it has a spin half nature, so we should be insensitive to the sign, it has to be the square. But up to that, twister space is the phase space of particles in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Now, we cheated here slightly in that these spinners are complex. So we are talking about some strange complexified phase space. That's directly related to the fact that, well, we should really be talking about particles moving in 2 plus 1 dimensions in spacetime. The boundary of the sitter is a three-dimensional Euclidean. And that is what makes everything complexified. So this picture of phase space in quantum mechanics would be literally true if we were talking about Lorentzian ADS, where the boundary is a Lorentzian spacetime. And so here it's almost true, you just need to complexify. Okay. So we have this interesting holographic, baby holographic statement that the evolution of free massless fields of different spins in the sitter is governed by some basic operation in the quantum mechanics of a boundary particle. Now, I keep saying different spins, but if we are precise, so if you remember the homogeneity of a twister function is encoding the spin of the four-dimensional field. If we want to talk about just arbitrary operators in the boundary particles quantum mechanics, then we should talk about arbitrary twister functions, so sum over all the homogeneities. This will give us every spin exactly once. Okay? So the quantum mechanics of the boundary particle is trying to talk somehow about a bulk theory that has massless fields of all spins. Of course, at the free level, we don't care. We can separate them. But maybe we can go to the interacting level in the bulk. So what does it mean, interacting? It means that bulk fields get combined in some nonlinear ways. Okay, they get multiplied, and there are many ways to combine fields nonlinearly. That would correspond to different interactions. Usually we constrain them to be local in spacetime. But now let's try something different. Let's use as our rule for combining things nonlinearly the product of operators in this quantum mechanics. That's the only thing we are allowed to do if we have this operator representing a bulk field is to just multiply it in the operator algebra of the quantum mechanics, okay, which in the language of the phase space slash twister functions is represented by the so-called Mayall-Star product. If you know what it is, great. Okay. So if we construct an interacting theory of this kind, then two things will be true about it. First, it will be very likely, and in fact it turns out to be true, non-local, because we didn't say anything about multiplying fields at the same point in spacetime and integrating. We're doing this strange thing with a non-commutative algebra and twister space. So we have non-local interactions. We have massless fields of all spins. We have these interactions that we constructed have a huge symmetry now, which is all the possible changes of basis in the boundary particles Hilbert space. Okay, because the operator product doesn't care about the basis. Okay, so changes of basis are themselves represented by operators. Okay, so we have this now infinite dimensional symmetry that is represented by, again, arbitrary operators in the boundary particles quantum mechanics, which, as we already know, are described by massless fields of all spins in the bulk. Okay, so we are getting an interacting theory that has an infinite dimensional gauge symmetry carried by massless fields of all spins. Okay? So I claim that this is a perfectly valid introduction into the existence and basic properties of higher spin gravity. Okay. And now I'm going to cheat because I started late. Who's the boss? I have 5 minutes, right? Yeah, I do. So now let me show you something cool. What is the S matrix of higher spin gravity in De Sitter? Now, notice I told you almost nothing about what higher spin gravity actually is. I didn't teach you the Vasiliev equations. I didn't tell you what the interactions are like, but I told you what their symmetry is. So what can we say? So now that we know all the dictionaries at the free level, we can just take them for granted. Now, as always, to get the S matrix between two horizons, we first do one horizon. This will be very important. And we want to relate the field data on the boundary to field data on the horizon. Okay, the field data on the boundary, we can encode equivalently as through the boundary to bulk propagator as a linearized field in the bulk, if we wish. Or we can skip that step, but in any case, the data on the boundary can be encoded just as before by a twister function. Let's call it F0. And the data on the horizon will be encoded by a different twister function. Let's call it F horizon. Okay, at the free level, by definition, we just take the linearized dictionary for granted, they are the same. They are the twister function that we've been talking about all along. But at the interacting level, so this extended into a linearized field is not the same as this extended into a linearized field, and our job is to find the nonlinear relationship between the two. Now, suppose somebody told you that the problem has the full higher spin symmetry. It doesn't. It's broken by the choice of the horizon. But suppose somebody told you that. Then the only answer you could possibly write was that the fields on the horizon were some function with through the quantum mechanical product star product of the input fields on the boundary with some coefficients, this is nth power. Okay, and we need to know more about the theory to determine these coefficients. In fact, I claim I know enough about the theory to determine them at the fully interacting but classical level, but not today. But if this is the case, then something funny happens, because if this is the case for one horizon, it's the case for any horizon. And therefore, we will get that the twister function for the initial horizon is the same as the twister function for the final horizon, which means that they are just related by the linearized dictionaries, that is by the free S matrix. Okay, so if we have full Harrispin symmetry, then there's no non-trivial mapping between the different horizons. But this is, of course, silly, because we don't have full Harrispin symmetry, just like we don't have full space-time symmetry. They are broken by the choice of this point. Now, in space-time, we know what the choice of this point does. Right? That we used to have just all the invariants of 5D rotations in this embedding space picture, and now, okay, we add in extra structure, this special vector representing this point, and now we know what which new invariants it can give us. But what's happening at the level of higher spin symmetry? So we need to somehow translate this choice of point into twister language, into the language of boundary particles, quantum mechanical operators. And here, because I have minus 3 minutes, I will just tell you that the choice of horizon is the same as the choice of boundary point, is the same as the choice of a null vector in the embedding space, is the same as the choice of a 2D subspace spanned by this guy in twister space, and the only twister function that that carries this information is delta with that restricts us to this 2D subspace. The delta turns out to be just delta with respect to one of the two components of the twister, which, remember, was the square root of the momentum on the horizon. So it will not be surprising that when we translate this twister function into an operator in the quantum mechanics, it will be the operator that projects onto the state of zero momentum. Now, zero spinner helicity, zero helicity spinner means zero momentum. Zero momentum, if you remember, the magnitude of the momentum is the frequency with respect to null time on the horizon. So it's the projector onto zero frequencies. Yeah, so the only structure that gets added into the Harrispin algebra by choice of horizon is a projector onto zero frequencies. So the only expressions for the nonlinear relationship between boundary and horizon that are not this, that are something more than this that we can write, will involve this only extra structure, namely will involve projectors onto zero frequencies. Therefore, the S matrix of higher spin gravity is given by the free one up to effects that must involve zero frequency modes. So the interactions are completely hiding in the soft sector. That is wonderful if you care about the sitter, because zero frequencies are sort of the same as infinite time. Infinite time is here, where the boundary and the horizon intersect. The boundary is where you're forced to live. The horizon is where you want to live. This looks tantalizing and beautiful. Let's solve this problem, and then let's claim that we solved the first ever sort of quantum gravity in an observable patch of the sitter space. Thank you very much. No, next time. But I must note past experience. Usually when I say that I will solve a thing for next time, I do. So give me your money, give me your students, it works. Yep.
Do you see this kind of stuff here as well, or in the theory?
So there is some small amount of confusion on this point, but most or all other versions of high spin holography, and of which there are many in ADS, make no sense in the sitter. So in particular, in order to avoid the problems of negative sign bulk fields, you must restrict to just even bulk fields, so the so-called minimal version of higher spin theory. Then you have basically just spinners or just scalars on the boundary. It seems that the signs come out wrong again if you choose the spinners, so you must choose the scalars. And then you're left only with this choice you mentioned between free and critical. There, I would just cautiously say that as far as the bulk is concerned, they are related to each other by a Legendre transform, and the free version is obviously simpler. So what I've been telling you here was secretly referring to the free CFT, because that can be reduced to the quantum mechanics of free particles on the boundary. So up to some possible nitpicks, there is only one version of higher spin holography that works in the sitter. And conspicuously, it is a version that's for which we don't know of any relationship to string theory.
More questions? Not